solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the third episode of Connecting the Dots. As you might know, we recently crossed 100 guests at the podcast, and we are pressing the pause button on getting new guests, and we are using the opportunity to take stock and reflect on some of the learnings we've had at the podcast over the years. For the next several weeks, each new podcast episode will be a compilation around a theme where I try and connect the dots between various things we've learned at the podcast across the guests. To put it differently, we want to pause collecting the dots for a while and focus on connecting them. I sincerely hope you will find these compilations helpful. Needless to say, we'll do this for a period of time, and then after a few months, we'll get back to the long-term march towards adding to the library of guests at the podcast. In case you're interested, the first two episodes were on self-awareness, internal and external self-awareness. As a natural extension, here's Connecting the Dots on listening. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm based in Mumbai, and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals play to their full potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is limited, and there are only so many people I can work with at one point in time. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen to play to their potential. To know more, please visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Just like self-awareness, listening, I'm realizing, is one of those never-ending journeys. I feel that I'm just beginning to scratch the surface here. But at least let me share what I've gleaned so far. But before we get into the what and how of listening, let me share a little bit around the why I feel it's super critical to pay attention to listening. I see three broad ways in which listening makes a difference to your leadership. I'm not even talking about the role of listening in building self-awareness, a topic we go deep into in the previous episode. Even if we keep that aside, I think there are three big links between listening and leadership effectiveness at the top. And I would even go on to say that bad listening is a sort of a glass ceiling at the top that nobody talks about. The first reason has to do with the leadership competency that becomes critical at the top. I find that at the CEO on the CXO level, collaborative influencing becomes the competency that differentiates the great from the average. And collaborative influencing refers to your ability to get things done through your peers, where you don't really have authority. And I find that the most important ingredient for this competency is how you listen. The second reason I feel it's even more important is that when you move from heading a function to heading a business, you often move from operating in a domain of familiarity and competence, where you're familiar with 80% of what's going on, to a space where you probably know less than 20% of the various things that are in your span of control. In that scenario, how well you listen can make a big difference to your ability to be an effective leader. And the third reason why I feel listening is super critical at the top is because it's a key prerequisite for judgment. Are you listening to the silent voices in the room? Are you listening to the story behind the story? Are you listening to the mandate and the political agendas of your key stakeholders? And so on. While listening is critical at any point in time, I find that at the very top, quality of listening separates the wheat from the chaff. Now let's dive in and unpack some of the themes around listening. The first piece I want to talk about is around asking the right kinds of questions. I've noticed that a lot of our training is often around unearthing the what, how, and the why. But there is the when and the where, which can sometimes evoke a story, and that can often be richer than a razor-sharp but bland why. Here's Indraneel Chakraborty, author of Stories at Work, speaking about story listening.
Sometimes stories trigger stories because you remember another moment in time where something like that happened. So one way to elicit stories is to tell another story. Another way to elicit stories is to actually turn the story pyramid upside down. What is the story pyramid? And you've been in McKinsey, so I'm sure you've read the whole book, which is the most important question is why. Yeah.
Pyramid
then,
principle.
Yeah, and then how? No, this is not the pyramid principle. This is basically saying the question pyramid. So the most important question is why, then how, then what. The country cousins somewhere not important are when and where. The problem with this when it comes to eliciting stories is the why, how, and what are opinion generating questions. Why do projects go wrong in this company? You're not going to get a story. You'll say because of, you know, they are underfunded or don't have management oversight. Yeah. Or how do you choose a great trainer? Mm-hmm. Oh, you choose a great trainer by doing ABC. No stories. But if I were to turn this pyramid and put the why, when and where question as the most important. So when was the last time you actually got the right trainer? And how did it happen? That'll take you to a moment in time and get me a story. Where did you last see great application of knowledge? It'll take you a moment in time and get a story. This process of asking questions that take you to a moment in time and get a story is what we call story listening.
Very interesting. And how do you, again, maybe wearing a consultant's hat here, sometimes when you ask the why question or the what question, you're expecting people to process multiple stories and come up with the net insight. And sometimes asking them to throw up a data point might, you know, deprive you of that aggregated insight. Is there a loss there?
So I don't think this is a either or situation. There are times where I might want to, and I'm sure there are many times when I want to ask the why question, where I want you to aggregate your understanding. There are times when I want an individual example. Now, one of the things that I think is grossly misused in business, and I've been told this for many, many times as a marketer, and I wish I had the answers I have now. You know, I would go for a market visit. I would come back very excited about an observation and I would table it saying, you know, what I saw, this was this. And then some senior guy would say, there is no room for anecdotal evidence. Yeah, we need data. Yeah. I wish I had the definition that I have now. My new definition is data is nothing but a plural of anecdote. Yeah. And so there's nothing wrong with looking at those individual stuff. Because the richness is in the individual stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. When you give me your why, I don't always have the reason why you've come to that why. If I have to understand how you've come to that why, I need to go behind and look at some of those individual stuff. So again, I don't think it's either or.
Fair.
It's when you want that richness, the texture of where that final opinion comes from, that a story listening might be more important.
Got it.
Asking the why question might feel more efficient, but I notice when and where might be more effective and come packaged with much more context. A related point here about listening to stories is that the human mind has a way of quickly attaching itself to a simple sounding but plausible story, and then that often closes us to more nuanced possibilities. Jennifer Garvey Berger, a leading thinker around the area of leadership in complexity, speaks about how millions of years of evolution has led to this default wiring and how we should resist the temptation to fall for the simplistic sounding but plausible story.
Yes, this question about causal thinking. So humans love to figure out causality, right? It's one of the ways our mind works. And I think it's why we've been such really good problem solvers. We do that by pulling things apart, taking them apart and trying to examine them. And humans have been doing this for as long as we know, as long as we can track them. My son is using this space. My son is in university, is using this space to be rereading a lot of ancient philosophy. And you just see people trying to make sense of the causality, the way to create particular outcomes, happenings. And so I think this is a thing humans have been trying to do for a long time, and it's had extraordinary benefits. And the more interconnected the world is, the more issues of simple cause and effect are very unhelpful. So the question about whether this is new or not, humans have always loved this thing. But I think, and it's always had like its downside in an unpredictable space. But a lot of the world has been, while it's been quite unpredictable, it hasn't been so interconnected as it is right now. And so I think the downside of our causal thinking is growing as things get more more complex. We see that in the COVID situation, just as we look at different governments trying to figure out what will cause the slowing of the virus without causing the ruining of the economy, right? This is the thing that so many people are, governments are trying to figure out. And as long as you're in a kind of linear way of thinking about the world, you're not going to be able to actually respond to the interconnecting forces, and you're not going to be able to take action quickly enough, really. So, or action that's suitable for complexity quickly enough. So you get this strange blend of people talking about COVID-19 as though we really understood the cause and effect of things, when really in this complex world, we couldn't possibly understand what makes Italy the way Italy is and what makes Singapore the way Singapore is. Like, we can just look at the little tiniest features that we think we can control. But even you and I thinking about like, what's the impact of pollution in large urban places? And does the impact of pollution, does that actually help the immune system, or does it degrade the immune system? Does that help the lungs recover? Does it degrade the possible? Like, we don't know. We don't know. And we may never know. We may never know.
I'm reminded of a conversation I was having with a candidate in the context of a search I was doing when I was at Egon Zehnder. I almost fell for the simple story, like Jennifer mentions. But luckily, I asked a different question, and I ended up with a very different perspective on the individual. This must have been around 2015. I was at Egon Zehnder, and I was conducting a search for the India country head for a large European engineering equipment company. The candidate was a senior leader who was heading a BU for a large American conglomerate. When I was going through his CV, I noticed that he'd spent 5 years to get an engineering degree, which typically takes 4. He'd graduated from one of the RECs in the South, now called NITs. I walked in with my assumptions about the individual and had my biases. In IIT, we would call these people 5x4s, people that took 5 years to complete a 4-year course. They were often individuals who were happy-go-lucky and didn't quite care about adhering to the institute-prescribed timelines. They were often looked down upon by the rest of the community. As I was engaging with this individual, I asked him about that passage of time in his life. Suddenly, the floodgates opened. He went on to talk about the fact that he grew up in Kashmir and the militancy context there. He spoke about how at one point he was 30 seconds away from being blown up and how he survived. He went on to talk about the fact that his college REC, now NIT Srinagar, was shut for a few months because of this. And as a result, he had to complete his education in a different REC. And that added extra time to his graduation. Long story short, I walked away from that meeting with a very different understanding of the leader, his resilience, attitude to life, and so much more. I realized that I wouldn't have learned this about him if I hadn't taken him back to that moment in time and engaged in the when and where questions. Like Indraneel says, in the pursuit of brevity and simplicity, let's not miss out on the rich tapestry of human experiences that we can all learn from. I now want to move to a slightly different topic on listening. Very often we focus on the specific content of what's being said. There's something to be said about tuning into the underlying emotion behind a message. I got a wonderful glimpse into this when I was speaking with Bombay Jayashree, the Padma Shri award-winning Carnatic musician. She happens to have lent her voice to the title track in the movie Life of Pi, directed by the Oscar-winning director Sir Ang Lee. She speaks about how Sir Ang Lee listened to the song to see if it evoked an emotion of safety in the child.
With reference to Ang, he's zen-like. He's calm, he speaks very little, but he will affectionately prod you to deliver what he wants. While rendering this song, I remember we recorded this in Bombay, and the song is very small, it's about 4 or 6 lines. But it took over a week to record that, to get finally where Sir Ang wanted us to, in Michael Danner. At the end, I think what he told me is, I want the child not to sleep to your lullaby. I want the child to feel safe. And I want that in your voice. And if you look at the way they have the song plays through the film, of course it lulls the child to sleep. It also wakes Pi up. It gives him the courage. And more importantly, it's the song, the track is used as a connect between the audience and Pi throughout. Only when I thought deeply, I realized how the song plays through the movie. So to work with someone, Sir Ang is universal. He may be Taiwanese on paper, but it's fascinating to work with somebody like him who loves what he does and knows what to get from the artist that he's working with.
That's fascinating. 5 days for a 6-line song. So how do you break that up? I mean, what happens in those 5 days? In the sense, even that simple thing you said about, you know, understanding the emotion of the song and bringing it in your voice. How does that play out for an artist?
So I think it was very similar to how I practice Carnatic music. Basically, over that 5 days, though it was 5 lines or 4 lines, I was internalizing the melody. And it was a simple melody. It was an intense but very simple melody. So I remember even in sleep, those 4 lines were going on in my head. And I think that process is what was beautiful, and that was what was required, and that was why I was given the time. So I could internalize, and not just, if you see a mother singing to a child, it's not something she's learned 5 minutes ago. It's something she may have heard her grandmother sing or mother sing, which is inside her. And I'm lucky I was given that time to internalize it at least for 5 days. And interestingly, neither of them knew Tamil. But they wanted words that sounded, that had that relationship. When you hear the work, they wanted that warmth, that affection, the motherly love. So I would pick words, and they say, no, not this. This is a little harsh.
So you wrote the song, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Wow, okay.
And they were constantly telling me, no, I want a word ending in A, I want a word ending in O. I don't want too much of sounds like R,
right,
which is there in Tamil. But they wanted the whole thing to be soft, melting, butter-like. So even for it, because they knew the audiences, it's a universal audience, and they wanted the sounds emanating from the lullaby, just not the voice, but the sound had to be that of affection.
Let's move from listening with our hearts to listening to our heart. A lot of us are trained to use our heads while we make key decisions. We often miss out on listening to valuable signals from the heart in this process, especially during high-stakes transitions. Amish Tripathi is now a celebrated author, but if you go back in time with him, you will notice that he actually graduated from IIM Kolkata and worked in the financial services world before he made the transition into the world of writing. He speaks about how he listens to his head and heart for very different reasons.
So I always suggest that you should use your heart to decide the destination, but use your mind to plot the journey. So I was very clear that I was not going to give up on my book, no matter what, no matter how many people rejected it. I was going to do everything that I could to make it work. आगे चले ना चले भगवान के ऊपर है, बट आई विल डू माई बेस्ट, दैट आई वॉज वेरी क्लियर ऑन.
श्योर.
नाउ दैट वॉज द डेस्टिनेशन दैट माई हार्ट हैड डिसाइडेड, सो वॉट शुड द जर्नी बी टू दैट. आई अलाउड माई माइंड टू मेक अप माई माइंड, विच इज आई अलाउड माई माइंड टू मेक अप माई डिसीजन.
श्योर.
विच इज वाई आई डिड नॉट रिजाइन फ्रॉम माई जॉब, विच इज वाई आई इन्वेस्टेड ओनली इन टू द मार्केटिंग ऑफ द बुक, बट आई इन्वेस्टेड ओनली वट आई कुड अफोर्ड फ्रॉम माई सैलरी. आई डिडन्ट टेक लोन्स फ्रॉम एनी वन. आई ऑफकोर्स डिडन्ट आस्क any of my relatives, anyone for anything, only my money. I invested only what I could afford.
Uh-huh.
I was lucky that I had family support for this. My wife, my siblings, because, if you don't have that emotional support, it's not about financial support, it's that emotional support.
True.
Then that can kind of, draw energy away from you. And, that family support is extremely crucial. And, of course, I'm lucky in that sense, but I would also say that it's a responsibility of each individual to try and get that support, to enroll people around him into his journey.
I love the pithy insight from Amish. Use your heart to decide the destination, but use your mind to plot the journey. So simple yet so profound. If I were to reflect on my journey over the last 7 years, post leaving Egon Zehnder to my current role as a coach and a sounding board, I notice that I've started tuning more and more into how I feel in the context of a client. Earlier, it was a lot about the person, the industry, the fees, the future potential, and so on. Not to say they're not important, but of late, I've started tuning into how I feel at the end of a conversation. Do I feel energized? Do I feel I can build mutual trust with a person? And so on. And if I don't get a good feeling, I try not to take the client on. Even when I look at situations where I feel I haven't added as much value, and it was a less fulfilling relationship, I notice that very often I had picked up something in the gut in the first few interactions. I've started tuning into it more and more often. We just listened to the insider on listening to our heart. Of late, I've also started realizing the value of tuning into my body. I've started realizing the intelligence that our body possesses and started paying attention to what my body is trying to tell me. Jennifer Garvey-Berger speaks about it here.
I mean, there's this way that many of us have been taught over centuries in our cultures and our societies that the mind is the great thing and the body is sort of the source of temptation or misleading data. And so we've learned to not trust or believe what our body tells us and really think that it's the mind that is the most glorious human achievement. Actually, when we look at sort of our psychobiology, our body is giving us signals all the time that our mind is making sense of very, very quickly and often reacting to without noticing that it was an embodied sensation that we were reacting to. So if we give someone, some studies that are greater, like if you give somebody a shot of adrenaline and then you have them meet a stranger, depending on the gender of that stranger, they're either likely to be more drawn to that person as a love interest or more threatened by that person as a possible threat or enemy after this shot of adrenaline than they were under normal circumstances. And they tend to attribute that to the other person, right? And they don't attribute that to their bodies in any way. And so their body is giving them a signal, and then they're acting out of that signal without ever noticing that the signal happened. This is very dangerous, right? That we're responding to data by taking action in a way that's completely divorced from our seeing of the data in the first place. So we need to get much more in touch with what our body is telling us. I see leaders all the time, and you see there are studies about this as well. People who go into meetings hungry, because leaders I work with are very busy, and they hate all the ideas, Like, they hate all the ideas on the table. None of the ideas are quite right. Well, is this about the quality of the ideas, or is this about the fact that you didn't have time for lunch? Like, we don't tend to think, oh my goodness, I hate these ideas because I have no blood sugar and I have no creativity left. But actually, this is the way our bodies work. You know, there's fabulous studies of the thing that makes you most likely to get parole when you are in front of a parole board in prison is how close to a break the judges are when they look at your case. If you're right after they ate lunch or breakfast, then you're very likely to get paroled. If you're right before it's time for a break or a meal, you're very unlikely to get paroled. Now, this has nothing to do with the merits of these cases, right? Wow. This is completely because the judges are responding to a bodily sensation, but they don't know that they're responding to a bodily sensation. So they think they're responding logically. If we're more in touch with our bodies, we can avoid those mistakes.
Got it. Now I'm smiling to myself here as we speak. My wife uses the term hangry.
Yes, right. Like, this is a very clever way of understanding a signal that your body is giving you so that you don't blame other people for it.
Got it. No, but one is clearly the stomach and the hunger. But are there other common bodily signals that you see leaders missing? Are there one or two things that stand out for you apart from hunger, which you spoke about?
Oh, absolutely. Anxiety. Anxiety is huge, right? When we feel anxious, we make more protective decisions. We make more short-term decisions. And many organizations have leaders rushing so quickly from meeting to meeting, from crisis to crisis, that leaders spend a lot of their time anxious and not noticing that they're anxious. It's just like their regular way of walking through the world. They don't even notice that they're stressed or anxious, which is why mindfulness has come roaring into organizations, right? Because actually it gives you a moment to notice what's going on inside you, which then helps you decide, how do I want to relate to this thing that's going on inside me? If I had a bad meeting an hour ago and it made me anxious, and then I come into this meeting now and I haven't dealt with that anxiety, I'm going to be ruled by this sort of short-term fear-based narrow vision that anxiety produces in the brain and in the body with this cortisol that rushes through my bloodstream. And I'm going to act out of that place probably without even noticing that I was anxious because of a thing that happened just now.
And maybe just to understand this further, Jennifer, even if we take anxiety, one would think it's a feeling or a signal to be processed from the mind. How do you think of this as a signal from the body? How does one listen to that signal?
You can notice, what does it do to your body, right? You can notice, like, what does anxiety show up as? Or are your palms sweating? Is your heart beating? What's your breathing doing? Do you clench your thighs or your belly under these circumstances? Like, we can tune into, what are the signals I'm getting? Because the mind rationalizes things, right? Like, the core of this book is that we're constantly rationalizing the decisions we're making, the data we're processing. And so we can't just believe that we've got access to it. We need another set of clues, and figuring out what's going on in our body is very useful. The best way to process anxiety, by the way, is to exercise. So we actually want to burn it off. These hormones are in our bloodstream. And it's one of the problems with this lockdown right now is, how are people able to sweat out the anxiety that they're feeling versus how much are they just having this build up in them? Because anxiety is also particularly bad for long-term health and it's bad for our immune systems. It's bad for our mental and physical health. So being more connected to what's going on in your body is extraordinarily helpful in complexity.
I've also started believing in managing our energy rather than managing our time as a key element of driving productivity. I feel listening to our body is a key prerequisite for us to tune into our internal energy forces and get work done. A lot of my clients end up being type A leaders who push themselves really hard. Very often, it's a fine line between being tough and resilient and being stupid. A key regulator here, I feel, is truly listening to your body rather than just steamrolling through with sheer reservoir of willpower. Matt Dixon, a triathlon coach who's worked with several high-profile CEOs in Silicon Valley, including Sir Michael Moritz of Sequoia, talks about the criticality of recovery and how we all need to tune into the need for rest and how it can impact performance.
To be successful and to actually integrate the key components of rejuvenation and recovery, as well as training, what we have to realize is that we have to integrate it into a person's life so that not only does that can they improve in that discipline, because hopefully they're looking for improvement, but so that it can lift their health, it can lift their performance as a CEO or an executive, and it can help them thrive across all areas of life. And so it's all about integration. We go through a very particular process where we look at their habits at the start and we look at their genuine landscape of their life. What are the non-negotiables? And when we think about non-negotiables, there's obviously the commitments in the workplace. Quite often there's the commitment with their family, and we want them to be available and present for their family, their children, their wives, their husbands, whatever it might be. And then the other component that we have as non-negotiable is sleep. And saying, okay, how much are you sleeping? Is that necessary? And is it high enough quality, which is the other component of effective sleep, not just quantity? Are you getting enough? And with those building blocks in life, we have a certain amount of time left over. And that ebbs and flows with the different demands of life. But then we can go about saying the equation, with that time that is left over, how do we optimize it? How do we create an optimization mindset with that time that's left over? And that's a very different way of going about it. So rather than just dumping a training program on top of life,
a phrase that I'm trying to adopt in my life is being fit for purpose. There was a phase around a decade back where I was trying to lose weight and get fit. I started training for half marathons with a popular running group in Mumbai called Striders. I did one run and suddenly I realized that I was keen on running a half marathon under 2 hours. A sub-2 half, as it is commonly discussed in the running circles. I was able to tick that box in about a year's time. That's around the time our second child came along, who had his own sleeping schedule. My elder child was getting older, and there was a certain bus schedule which put pressure on my running schedule. I realized that I wasn't sleeping well enough at night, and I was struggling to focus at work. To use Matt Dixon's words, I was trying to dump a training program on top of life, and clearly it wasn't fitting. And I remember at that time my wife asked me a simple question. What are you running after? We spoke about the Clementine mirror in the previous episode on self-awareness. This was one such moment that was quite clarifying. Long story short, today my fitness regimen consists of a combination of some weight training 3 days a week and some cardio where I run for about 30-40 minutes. I have nothing against people who are running full marathons and ultra marathons and so on. Just ask yourself the question, are you being fit for purpose? Or are you chasing a random goal? Listening to your body is a good place to start. Let's now move to a different aspect of listening. Very often, when listening gets discussed, it's often about paying attention to the other side, the person who's speaking. How do we focus on not just what the person is saying, but the body language and tune into why that person holds a certain set of beliefs and worldviews? Rajiv Vij speaks about the third level of listening, which is about paying attention to what's happening inside us when we listen to the other person. It tells us a lot about our beliefs, conviction, mental models, relationship with the other person, and so on.
Yeah. I think, so just to clarify the three levels. So one is what you're saying, right? So let's say you are saying you made a hurtful comment, right? So that's what I'm hearing. And so that's one level of listening. I'm only reacting to or picking up only what you are saying. The other is I am empathetically listening and understanding, you know, you made a hurtful comment. Where is it coming from? Oh, you must be feeling frustrated about that issue. Or maybe you're feeling let down. Or, you know, so now I'm being really empathetic and trying to engage in my mind on the feelings that you are experiencing, which are leading you to say what you're saying, right? So that's the next level. The final level, which is pretty hard, quite powerful, is understanding what's going on within me. So when you made a hurtful comment and now I'm saying, oh, you know, maybe you got hurt about something, maybe I let you down in some way or something. What's going on within me? Maybe I'm feeling frustrated. Maybe I'm feeling angry. Or maybe I'm feeling regretful. And so on. And connecting with all these levels is so important because that raises the quality of the conversation. Firstly, it is going to alter my response, right? If I reacted to what you say something hurtful, I react to it, we know where that conversation is going to go. If I'm a little more empathetic and I understand where it's coming from, I will respond in a little better manner, right? Hopefully I'm kind of appreciative of where you are, what's happening, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm still not mindful of my own limitations here, which is that when somebody says something that seems sensitive, I very easily get into a very permissive mode because I like being kind to people. Right? So again, if the communication and the interaction is not going to be most transformational or most effective because, okay, I picked up your sort of emotional cues, but my own emotional flaws or my own emotional triggers are still at play. So if I can become aware that, hey, I know I'm getting drawn into this emotional drama because that's my tendency. If I'm just aware of that, maybe I'll respond differently. And hence we will move forward on that conversation in a very calm, assertive, authentic, meaningful way. And it'll become a transformational conversation. So that's kind of the three levels of three layers of listening that I've noticed.
As we think about listening to ourselves, it is critical that we have a healthy relationship with our inner voice, the little bird that's often tweeting away in the background. However, this relationship could also become a little unhealthy, and it's important that we watch out for this distinction. Professor Ethan Cross of the University of Michigan calls it the chatter, when our negative self-talk goes on a hyperdrive. He brings out the distinction between the inner voice and inner chatter.
Sure. So we have this remarkable tool. We can use language to work through our problems, and we can do it silently. We call that capacity our inner voice. So you turn your attention, we try to verbally work through a problem. You may think about what, you know, rehearsing a speech or what you might say to someone else, trying to motivate yourself, trying to create a story to explain your circumstances. This all involves turning your attention inward and using language to work through a problem. It's an incredible tool, a very valuable asset. Yet sometimes we try to activate this tool when we're struggling, when we have big, big problems, and it doesn't work well for us. Instead, it in a certain sense jams up. So we've got a problem. Let's say we were just rejected or insulted by someone. Hey, well, why did this happen? We try to think through that problem, often because we want to learn from our experiences and move on. But instead of coming up with that solution, we start stumbling. We just keep on rehearsing what happened to us and why we felt in ways that keep our negative emotions alive. And so that cycling over what happened to me, why did I feel this way, and that inability to work through and resolve the experience, that's what I call chatter. And I think it's one of the big problems that we face as a species.
Now, one of the people I spoke to on this podcast was a lady called Tasha Urich, who's done some work on self-awareness. And she uses a phrase, a rabbit hole of rumination. And she says sometimes introspection, if we don't do it well, we can end up going that rabbit hole and it can be counterproductive.
That's exactly right. That's so. Mm-hmm. So chatter, you know, chatter is a term that encompasses rumination. So in case you haven't figured this out yet, I'm sure you have, and many of your listeners have as well. Scientists are really good at creating distinctions between slightly different things and coming up with different phrases to describe them. So rumination, perseveration, worry, and there's a whole host of additional terms that are often used to refer to this process of getting stuck in a negative thought. And so I use the term chatter to capture the breadth of those different experiences, all of which the common feature is looping over the negative thoughts, going down the rabbit hole, sucked into that vortex of negativity that won't let you free.
And you say that while the inner voice functions well most of the time, it often leads to chatter precisely when we need it the most, when our stress levels are high, when the stakes are high, and when we encounter difficult emotions that call for the utmost poise. So can you talk a little bit about that paradox in terms of when we need it most and when it lets us down the most?
Yeah, so we often need the tool the most when we're struggling with big emotions that command our attention and don't let us focus on anything else until those emotions are essentially resolved and subside. The problem is that experiencing stress often engages many of the brain networks that we use to manage the stress. So if you think of the frontal cortex, which plays a key role in helping us down-regulate negative emotions, it also plays a role in keeping those negative emotions active. So it's as though the very resource that we possess that is useful for helping us manage the mind is depleted when we most need it. And that's where I think it's so valuable to understand what tools exist for helping people navigate this impasse so that they can, in fact, regain control of their mind, so to speak, when they find themselves slipping down this rabbit hole.
And from a self-awareness perspective, Ethan, just for me to understand, where is the line between, let's say, the inner voice and inner chatter? When does it tip over to becoming unhealthy? Do you have sort of a rule of thumb for it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I could, you know, it would be a dream if I could do a blood test to figure that out, or have a little chatter thermometer that physiologically indicated that, oh, you're in the harmful zone right now. The best we can do at the moment is a more subjective appraisal of where you stand. And the indicator for me is it's not about whether you're engaging in negative self-talk. Many people think, I want to rid my life of all negative self-talk. That's not actually a goal that I would argue is a healthy goal or an attainable one. What I mean by that is this. Negative emotions are functional when they are experienced in the right proportions. It is healthy and adaptive to become angry for a short period of time when insulted. The experience of envy when you come across some colleague or friend who's achieved in a way that you haven't, that can be very motivating and it has been shown to be such. The anxiety that I experience when I think about all of the things I have to do next week, that's useful because what it allows me to do is not just watch TV and read for fun, but actually do the work that I need to do to prepare. So negative emotions in small doses are great. And with those negative emotions comes that negative self-talk. What makes those emotions harmful is when they're prolonged. So if you find yourself turning over the same negative experience in your mind in a way that's not, you know, progress forward and take constructive action, that's an indication that chatter is taking hold. If you find yourself sitting at the dinner table with your family, asking your family questions that they answer and respond to, but which you don't hear, you hear physically, of course, what they're saying, but you don't attend to it. So you ask them to repeat themselves, whereupon they say, I just told you that. That's an indication that the chatter is becoming harmful. If you find yourself unable to sleep at night, because your mind is racing over the negativity, not allowing you to turn off your brain for the 8 hours that you need to get the slumber, that's a sign that the chatter has taken over.
If you find that your thoughts are often hijacked by inner chatter, you might like to tune into my conversation with Ethan, where we speak about some tactics that can help us overcome chatter. You can find him in the guest section at playtopotential.com. Let's now turn our attention to listen to the signals from the outside world. The first question that comes up is, which voices do we listen to? I noticed that leaders who are deliberate about this often have a personal board of advisors that they've thoughtfully put together, almost like how a company assembles a board of directors. Here's Ramesh Srinivasan, a senior partner in McKinsey, speaking about his personal board of directors and how they engage.
I also find it very critical to have networks outside, people who can be mentors, sponsors, advocates for you outside. I have my own group of advisors. We're a group of about 12 of us who meet the first Tuesday of every month. And these are all people outside McKinsey who are deep friends, but also mentors of mine. And you know, unless there's a real, there's a crisis or a really, really critical personal and professional commitment, I don't miss that session with my call it board of advisors or mentors that I have outside. And then the last point I'd make is the power of weak networks. Some of my friends in operations management have told me, your opportunities often come from weak networks, not just from advocates or sponsors. If you have a sponsor, they probably have already thought of all the opportunities that might be there for you. So maintaining that group of broader networks is so important, because often new breakthrough opportunities come from that. That would be the last advice or tip I'd have for people, Deepak.
Mm-hmm. And coming back to your board of advisors, Ramesh, I respect the sensitivity and the confidentiality, but any themes around the kinds of people you have in that board of advisors?
I actually have a wide group of people. So it has business leaders, it has a few people from government, a few lawyers, a few investors, people who are savvy about technology, media. So it's a wide group that is at least a few people who are similar enough to me, but a bunch of people who are different that then pushes my thinking and allows me to stay relevant and both be interested and interesting in the world, Deepak.
Mm-hmm. And if I may persist, Ramesh, first Tuesday of every month, you said, how do you set the agenda when you meet? Is it free-flowing, or is it something that you pay attention to and plan ahead of time? How do you extract the value out of the board?
So we take turns in handling the agenda each time. So one person roughly every month takes control of the agenda. But we also have the first part of the meeting. We meet for two and a half hours. So the first 45 minutes to an hour is just a check-in, where we go around and each of us talks about what's happened in the last month and a question or challenge that we're facing. And then the second part is really after the person who's leading the agenda at that meeting. So for example, recently I brought up the topic of racial equity and what should leaders do, especially in the U.S. environment, and how open should we be, and what can we do to have impact. So each of us brings a topic and then facilitates a discussion for an hour, hour and a half on that specific topic. That's the second part, Deepak.
I must confess that while I have a network of mentors and well-wishers that I reach out to from time to time, I haven't quite formally architected a board of advisors like Ramesh has. It's clearly a work in progress for me. I love his point about how opportunities often come from weak links. Herminia Ibarra of London Business School speaks about three kinds of networks.
Sure, I mean, we do, past a certain point in our careers, we do everything through relationships. That's how we get things done. That's how we find out what's going on. That's how we get advice, perspective, everything. And most people who are doing well have very good operational networks that just help them get the day-to-day work done more smoothly. Maybe, you know, they'll get something done faster for them, or they'll get the information they need sooner. But, you know, it is really kind of what's in the critical path of my routine day-to-day work. That's the operational network. The personal network is the part that is, you know, the people you've worked with who've become friends and you've stayed in touch with, and there's more emotional quality to it, or maybe some old mentors, and there's often common interests. They're longer term relationships, and most of us have those too. And then the hard part, the tricky part, is the strategic network, which has to do, you know, if the operational is about you today, the personal often is about your past. The strategic's about your future, and it's about how do you connect the dots between some of your interests and relationships that are maybe external to your company, some of the internal relationships, help connect people, help bridge across different areas, help bring new ideas in, help export new ideas. It's really where you're adding unique value in the context of your work, but in the more strategic aspects of it. Mm-hmm.
And maybe just to bring that aspect to life, Herminia, because a lot of the one and two almost come by default because, you know.
They happen more organically. The strategic, you have to work at it.
Deliberate. So are there a couple of examples you could share of people who've been thoughtful about cultivating these networks,
well,
given the journey?
You know, one example that struck my eye a couple of years ago, is the one that's first coming to my mind, is when Beth Comstock was still at GE as chief marketing officer, she felt that she was oftentimes much more connected to the outside world than most people in operational jobs at GE, which tended to be more internally focused. And so she felt, even though it wasn't part of the job description, that part of what she could do was bring the outside in for those people. And the example that I loved is she was at a book talk in Silicon Valley for the launch of The Lean Startup by Eric Ries about fast prototyping, which originally was a book written for startups. How do you go to scale quickly, minimum viable prototype? But she just thought, you know, aha, we're taking too long in our product development, our turbines are taking too long to develop, and I bet we could use some of these ideas in a more classic manufacturing context. Let me make the connections. And she did. And a big part of GE Aviation then got trained on these methods to kind of make the process more agile. So that for me is a great example of how you can be strategic. You've got access to something others don't. And so you see the idea here and the need there, and you bring them together.
As we go forward in our journeys, I guess it is critical for us to be deliberate about the networks we listen to, which in turn have a bearing on the possibilities that open up for us. While seeking feedback from some of these sources is a nice-to-have and not a do-or-die situation, I notice that this element becomes super critical during phases of transition. It is imperative that leaders architect fit-for-purpose feedback loops, and if required, hire the services of a coach to listen to some of these voices. Without this feedback loop, a small hairline crack can quickly cascade into a full-blown fracture in no time, given the incoming leader often doesn't have the network of goodwill that gives him or her the benefit of doubt in these situations. Michael Watkins, professor at IMD, and one of the leading thinkers in the space of transition acceleration, speaks about this.
Yeah, I think it's easier to do if you've got a coach involved because you've got someone who can, you know, go in there and get that feedback. But just to start with the basic premise, Deepak, that, you know, in general, organizations do a poor job of providing feedback to leaders in new positions, especially when they're brought in from the outside. And why is that? Because there's a sort of sense they have to get their feet, you know, that give them a chance, you know, or a reluctance on the part of, you know, direct reports to kind of give upward feedback, or in the case of the board just may not see, you know, what's going on. And so I'm a huge believer in providing structured feedback after, you know, pick a number, 90 to 120 days, certainly not longer than that, because that provides some discipline, you know, in the sense of giving some serious, structured guidance to the new leader upon which they can act before things have gotten to a point where, you know, there are very serious things going on. And so, you know, can the leader do that themselves? Absolutely. Should they? For sure. But I think it's often better done by, you know, having a coach who can go out and conduct those stakeholder interviews. And my process, basically, and probably yours is the same, Deepak, is I do an initial set of stakeholder interviews. And then after 60 to 90 days, I go back and meet the same people, right? So now I've got a little bit of a relationship with them. You know, I can, it just makes it easier to kind of collect the sort of, you know, real feedback about how this person is doing.
So what's the first set of conversation with these stakeholders, Michael, before the leader comes in? I get the 90-day conversation or 90 to 120-day conversation. What's the day zero conversation with these stakeholders?
Sure. So it depends a lot, again, just on that conversation with different types of transitions, whether it's an internal move or an external hire. In both cases, there's a conversation that's sort of almost like a SWAT-like conversation about what's the agenda? What are the challenges? What are the issues? You know, is there a common understanding of those things? And that's obviously something that the leader themselves can do. But surprisingly, an outsider often is able to get insights that it's harder for the leader to get. You know, and it makes no sense if you think about it, but people are often willing to say things to me that I'm not sure they would say to the leader that I'm working with, which is kind of weird, right? But, you know, and partly that's just my reputation and people know I'm not going to give them, you know, provide verbatim comments directly to the leader. I do it thematically. That's another thing is I have a lot of experience, right, in putting together this kind of data. So there's some value, I think, in doing that. For internally promoted people, there's often an additional piece, which is kind of about what do they need to really do to step up in the role. What concerns do you have about them moving into this new role? How do you see them needing to develop themselves to be fully effective in this role? So there's kind of that additional piece. But that's the kind of sort of upfront diagnostic work that I tend to do when we build into our processes. And then, you know, that 60 to 90 day piece is, again, kind of feedback oriented, right? How are things going? What are you going to do more of? What should this person be doing more of, less of, continuing to pursue? You know, that sort of structure.
During transitions, intentional listening can also be super critical for you to get an accurate lay of the land and understand what is the theory of change that could work. Ravi Venkatesan, a respected board member and author, speaks about how he listened when he took on the role of chairman at Bank of Baroda.
Yeah, so as you know, that about 18 months ago, I took on a completely new role as the chairman of a public sector bank.
Right.
Now, I know nothing about banking, and I know even less about public sector. But yet, Raghuram Rajan and Jayant Sinha felt that it was important that I take it on, so I did. Now, what do you do in this situation? And you know that the place is filled with landmines and you can step on anything and without realizing it and get blown up. So what you have to do is listen intently. And I did. I made it a very conscious effort to listen to a bunch of people, retired chairman of the Bank of Baroda. Okay, so help me understand from your perspective, you know, what I should do, what the issues are, how would you handle them?
Hmm.
You get a certain perspective. I went and spoke to Vagul of ICICI and PJ Nayak of Axis Bank, even though they've been around and seen the evolution of the banking sector. I've met a lot of our own employees and so forth. So from this, you begin to piece together first the situation, and then out of that emerges a theory of change, which is, you know, what interventions are really going to make a difference and who are going to be the important allies in this. If you don't listen and you start immediately, you come in with a point of view, you start, you know, jumping into action right away, you're going to make a lot of mistakes because you haven't picked built this nuanced and reasonably accurate picture of the landscape.
I guess we could go on and on. Let's pause here and do a quick recap of the ground we've covered. We spoke about the criticality of a when and where question in unearthing stories that are context-rich. We then spoke about how we resist the temptation to construct the simplest plausible narrative and carry an open mind with us. Years of conditioning has led us to believe in simple causality, which often doesn't work in a complex and a messy world. We then spoke about listening with our heart and then listening to our heart, especially during high-stakes transitions and decisions. We then discussed the criticality of listening to our signals from our body. Then we moved to discussing listening to what happens inside us when we listen to others. However, it's critical that we don't let the inner voice become a chatter, which can often be unproductive. We then move to how we listen outside in, and the fact that we need to take accountability to architect fit-for-purpose feedback loops and lean in towards networks and weak links that can open up new possibilities. These become all the more critical in high-stakes transitions where not listening can sometimes be fatal for a leader. By no means is this an exhaustive study of listening. I hope that this compilation provoked you to reflect in a few areas and gave you a few spaces where you could take a baby step in the right direction. Please do let me know if you have any feedback on the format. Anything you want me to do more of, less of, or anything you want me to do differently, that would be really valuable for me and my team. Thank you for tuning into the third episode of Connecting the Dots. If you want more, you can go to the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com and tune into the various nuggets under listening. You can also tune into the content from the various guests of the podcast by going to the guest section at playtopotential.com and finding the individuals there. Thank you for listening and for your attention. Do also consider rating and reviewing us on Apple or Spotify or wherever else you consume this content. It would mean a lot for us to keep raising the bar on what we do. We also have a WhatsApp group where we share one or two pieces of content every week. While we run the Connecting the Dots series, we'll be sharing nuggets along related themes. Over the next few days, we will share nuggets on listening to build on what we discuss here in this podcast episode. If you wish to receive this communication, you could just add this following number to your contacts and then send a message saying you're interested. The number is +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Just add this number to your contacts and send a WhatsApp message saying interested, and we'll ensure that we broadcast these nuggets to you. Thank you for patiently listening about listening. Bye now.